Now, we are going to go into our first interview for the program in the studio, and we are very happy to be joined by Dr. Simone Titone.
Simon Titone.
Okay. Sorry about that. I've just struggled a bit with some pronunciation. bear with me. Simon is a neuroscientist who grew up in New York and California, but has mostly been living and studying abroad since 2017. They're currently a master's student at Monash University. Simon is also non-binary and uses they/them pronouns. Now, we have Simon on to have a bit of kind of discussion, being from the United States. Simon has obviously been following and obviously has lived experience of the whole issue of, transphobia and queerphobia in the United States. And of course, the United States has been at the center of introducing a lot of quite awful anti-transgender legislation. And in fact, just something to kind of note as well, and a topic for a future program, but India is also introducing some really draconian anti-transgender legislation. I think the bill has actually just passed recently. Simon, maybe to kind of start off, I guess, the discussion, can you tell us about some of the latest anti-transgender bills that have been introduced across the US? What are some of the threats that Donald Trump has made, and what is the impact that this has had on marginalized communities?
So in terms of the way that I see it, the anti-trans legislation being brought into effect has very real-world impacts and harms our community greatly, but I mainly consider it to be kind of a progress bar for the overall goal of the ultra-right-wing government, which is, in effect, to bring about a white Christian national fascist state. The anti-trans legislation is kind of like a symptom of that main disease. I try to keep an eye on the government's progress in their mission, but from an international lens, I think it is important to remember that the framework that the current U.S. government is operating under, their eventual goal, does involve completely erasing the lives of trans and queer people, along with other marginalized groups such as disabled people, black and indigenous people, people of color, and in the end, anyone that they can scapegoat to continue their grasp onto control. These things affect people in really drastic and horrible ways, but it's kind of a fever when you're really quite sick with something else. In terms of the actual legislation themselves, on the anti-trans bill tracker webpage, there's 747 bills in 42 states right now. Most of those are attempted bills; they're not actually in effect, and most of them won't actually be successful. But the huge number and scale of that is on purpose to be overwhelming and. Many of them won't pass. Their goal is to induce feelings of hopelessness and despair.
I'll pass on to Mary to ask the next question.
Yeah, so has there been any resistance? Has the response of the pro-trans grassroots organizations to these attacks, what has it been, Simon?
Yeah, there is a lot of resistance. You said grassroots, and it really is kind of very local, non-televised. The revolution is indeed not being televised, but it's kind of on a very local scale, I think, at least in the type of resistance that is effective that I've seen, largely because there's just been consecutive institutional failures, one after another, basically, that have kind of led us to this point anyways. I think largely due to the kind of moderate, centrist Democratic, the DNC basically has kind of led to a lot of that kind of failure of institutional support for queer and trans people. But outside of California, I can't really speak to resistance that much, just because I don't have a lot of context there. But within California, there's I do have friends and allies who are mobilizing and connecting and yeah, there's consideration of eventual infrastructural failures that will affect basic survival elements like food and shelter, but also importantly, communications. One friend of mine has been working to establish a mesh network of devices that can communicate with each other without relying on other network infrastructure. And I think that's a really useful and important thing, because it kind of, community, it's kind of described as like a post-apocalyptic community, networking, but it is important in the various stages of potential infrastructural failures that we're seeing. On the topic of, basically on other levels, there have been mass protests on for quite a while. A lot of those are, mostly it's not aired on legacy media, certainly. There's no impetus for them to really share that with the world, I think, because it doesn't look great necessarily for the actual government in charge. But in terms of resistance as a whole, I think there's a really good resource to look to for that. One of the kind of most visible scholars of resistance history is Tad Stormer, who's recently written a book about the topic, but also makes I think pretty nicely digestible videos on TikTok and Instagram that kind of address both the history of resistance in the U.S. and kind of contextualizes that, which I think is for me very helpful, because it's incredibly overwhelming and frightening to resist fascism. It's just on a day-to-day scale, it's very, very scary, and it's it's very easy to get overwhelmed. I've dealt with that extensively on and off for the past 10 plus years, but it's important to remember that these fights have been fought before and continue to be fought in many other countries, and things are certainly very different from 100 years ago, but a lot of the fascist rhetoric is basically the same, and kind of relies on the same nationalist and supremacist exclusionary scapegoating tools that they use. So I'm hoping that looking to the past and seeing what's worked will be of effect in some way.
Well, I think just the next kind of question to kind of talk about is what can you tell us about some, because I guess one of the things that is now a bit part of the discussion about the US, because the discrimination against marginalized communities is so high, especially for the queer and trans community, there is this whole question around leaving the US, or even there's also this question of even seeking asylum in a country. Because, for the problems that that Australia does have, and there are plenty, Australia is relatively, quite good for LGBT rights, especially in the urban kind of centres. Rural areas, obviously, less so. So obviously, there's sort of almost a basis for a lot of people in the US, trying to actually come to countries like Australia to seek a better life. And I guess, what can you tell us about the work that even organisations like Help Me Leave US, which is an organisation that sort of focuses on this, have done, but also this kind of broader issue of seeking asylum as a trans person in the United States?
Yeah, it's challenging. I can say that for sure. But since 2016, I've kind of had this very overwhelming fear of being in the U.S. for a number of reasons. There's kind of a residual, or not residual, but baseline stress that is much higher there than any of the other countries that I've lived in. Partially because of the governmental policies, but also the gun violence is just absolutely insane. Basically, there's a lot of reasons to leave, particularly now with more direct attacks on queer and trans people. This organization, Help Me Leave, I encountered them on TikTok pretty early on when it was developing. It's kind of been spearheaded by this really impressive woman, Charlotte Richards, who is on TikTok, Charlotte en France, Charlotte with two T's and then E-N France. And then on Instagram, her handle is How to Topple Tyrants, which is great. And so it's kind of, I think, just started from seeing the issue and then, like, actually just doing something about it, which is incredible. But, yeah, I mean, now it's over 50 volunteers who are usually working full-time and then doing this on top of that. And it's basically just a collection of resources for people who are interested in leaving the country, and which is really super, super helpful because, I mean, one of the biggest hurdles is just not knowing what options there are out there. There's a lot, so many steps. The bureaucracy of moving to another country is absolutely insane. I mean, I lived in the UK for a year doing my first master's, and then in my PhD I was in Belgium for 4 years, so I have experience with kind of UK and European bureaucracy, and it is very challenging. I mean, also with Australian bureaucracy, which, yeah, they all have their pluses and minuses, but basically it takes a lot of background information to be able to kind of start that process. And this is an incredible organization, I think, that has they've assembled a lot of resources. There's a Discord server that has advice on options for immigration to over 35 countries. Charlotte's just recently put out that she's struggling a bit. She's working full time and trying to do all of this work on top of that. So she's trying to get help supporting her project so that she can devote more time to the to helping people. Please consider becoming a paid supporter of her Substack if that is an option for you. But yeah, also just looking at the information and kind of being aware of the resources out there, getting this publicized, I think, might be helpful as well. But yeah, it's an important cause, honestly. I mean, I think I have a lot of, I don't know, cognitive parallels to the, like, Nazi Germany and people being stuck there. And I mean, that's what I was thinking when I was like, prior to the 2024 election. Just how it's very, very difficult to leave once the regime has already been established. So that's, I was already very, like, cautious of that, I guess, and very keen to kind of, like, plan ahead because I know how challenging it is to leave. But yeah, asylum itself is not, it's like the last, like, worst case scenario, basically. There's a lot of really specific conditions. I looked into that for myself last year when there were developing anti-trans legislation happening. And it's very tricky. It wasn't available in Australia. And it requires that a country kind of makes a visible stance against the country that's kind of making these harms against their people. So a lot of countries aren't willing to do that, which I'm not sure if Australia will be willing to do that, but yeah, it is.
While you were talking just then, I was just visualizing boats coming from America with refugees on them. Yeah, so maybe that's what's going to be hitting our shores. Anyhow, my question is related to Australia now. So Australian polls before our last year's federal election showed support for the trans community was as high as 81% who agreed that trans people deserve the same rights and protections as all other Australians. So can you comment on the growing transphobic attacks from the far right in Australia, who've obviously been emboldened by President Trump, who's trying to spread his anti-trans crusade across the planet?
Yeah, that's a fantastic number. I feel really privileged and grateful to now be in a country that has that perspective. And I honestly think visibility is such a huge part of that. When trans people are visibly humanized, it can create a massive shift in perspective. And on the other hand, when trans people are reduced to being an issue, as happens when the only time we're discussed is when talking about bathrooms and sports, this dehumanizes us and makes us easier to pass legislation that can make our lives much more difficult and dangerous. The spread of far-right politics has been happening globally for a while now, and I honestly see it as being similar to how it was in World War II. Economic conditions are creating worse living standards for people, and rather than actually addressing issues and making people's lives better, right-wing populists are scapegoating marginalized groups and fear-mongering, which is basically deflecting responsibility and allowing them to hoard wealth. Because trans people make a small percentage of the population, it's much easier to dehumanize us and as a group and scapegoat us, since people are less likely to personally know someone who's out as trans. And I think that makes the biggest difference, is really just having a connection and humanizing someone on that level.
Yeah, and we've got probably 5 minutes left for this interview, so I might just skip to one of the questions, which is, I guess, why is it important that we stand with the trans community? And also, I guess, what are your thoughts on the kind of links between capitalism and oppression of the LGBT community?
Yeah, I mean, basically put, trans rights are human rights. We're people that deserve the same rights as anyone else. But if people need a more, not to be crass, but like self-centered reason, like consider the erosion of trans rights that's affecting cis people in all the time. While the UK is trying to tighten laws regarding bathroom usage, the slope becomes very slippery very quickly. So how do you enforce that someone uses the bathroom that they were associated at birth sex, their correct bathroom? By visual appraisal, there's many cis women who have more masculine features that would be called into question, and trans women who have no masculine features. And in the extreme, checking genitals would be insanely invasive and wouldn't make anyone safer. I would say anyone can get involved with trans right activism, as long as you're approaching the topic with respect and intention of being an ally and amplifying queer voices. And in terms of capitalism and its relation to the queer community, I think of capitalism as being an opportunistic feeder. It will basically consume anything for the sake of growth. So with rainbow capitalism, they're more than happy to extract wealth from queer people, but when it becomes socially unfavorable, as it is now in America, they abandon all support of queer people. And since the capitalist class will inevitably align itself with more right-wing leaders, as fascism starts to grow in power, the puppeteers of capitalism benefit from oppressing queer people through their alignment with power structures.
Would you like to make any last comments before we finish?
Yeah, I think that now is a time where creativity is needed more than ever. We tend to underestimate the power of creative storytelling in shaping the future directions of social groups, but I think at the moment where there's so many massive changes to our lives, like AI, like COVID, all of these things have massively changed the way that we think about ourselves and other people, and having stories about what the future could look like is so important, both as goalposts and warning signs, and to quote one of my favorite writers and thinkers, Ursula K. Le Guin, we live in capitalism. Its power seems inescapable, but so did the divine right of kings. So imagining a future outside of that is the first step to getting there, I think. So,
well, thank you very much, Simon, for being on our program. I think this has been a very important and good discussion.
Thank you. Thanks very much for having me.
Thanks, Simon.